It's different here. There's not a cubicle in sight. You won't find any one-size-fits-all business plans or formulas to follow here either. We see self-employment as an opportunity to share our unique gifts, passions, and eccentricities with others, so every citizen proudly creates a one-of-a-kind enterprise that is a perfect fit for them. We're a peace-loving tribe. We spend no time trying to convince others to quit their jobs and join us. We are delighted to be ambassadors, but we're not missionaries. Staying inspired is a daily practice here. We're not big on competition, although we love to collaborate. Here are a few other things to know about Joyfully Jobless Land. Citizenship, voluntary, language. English spoken along with every other language on earth, but you'll seldom hear words like can't or shouldn't. You will hear lots of conversation about ideas and encouragement. Currency. We operate with multiple currencies, of which money is one. Other popular currencies include satisfaction, laughter, joy, and innovation. Priorities. We place a high value on independence and creativity and urge every citizen to thoughtfully consider what matters most to them and to build a life that supports these things. Mission. To leave the world better than we found it. Dreamers welcome, whiners not so much. I pulled this text directly from the website joyfullyjobless.com. That's the site of my guest in today's episode because I thought it was indeed a perfect introduction to the phenomenon author, speaker, and publisher Barbara J. Winter is. I first came across Barbara through her book, Making a Living Without a Job, back in 2009. Till date, I still don't know who gave me that book or how I came to own it. So I choose to see it as some sort of divine encounter. One that caused me a plethora of problems because that book ruined me for future employers. Don't get me wrong, I was always diligent at my work. Because I'm a believer that whatever your hands find to do, you do with all your heart. But I found contentment at any role tough. And it's not surprising that I've ended up where I am today, years later. Barbara is a pioneering self-employment advocate who has spent the past 30 years pondering the question, why aren't we all self-employed? Helping others discover the joyfully jobless life is her favorite occupation, and you'll hear that passion splattered through this episode. She's the editor and publisher of the Winning Ways newsletter, and it's the longest running self-employment publication of its kind. Her book, Making a Living Without a Job, has been in print since 1993. She's a passionate teacher, as participants in her seminars will testify, and she leads retreats to help small business owners bring creativity and fresh ideas to their work. Though she's been at this game for such a long time, she still buzzes and speaks with such life when she talks about ideas and creativity and people working for themselves, and her joy is simply contagious. Honestly, this interview for me was like being that proverbial kid in a candy store. I'm a huge, huge fan of Barbara and just couldn't stop asking questions. For one, she's super fun to talk to, so the interview was easy. But it was also great to discover that we had a few things in common. For one, there's this deep-seated wanderlust we share. Barbara, as you'll hear in the interview, is an avid traveler. And two, we share a love for my second home, England. I know you will love this interview, and I honestly can't wait for you to hear it. My name is T.R.E., and you're listening to the Girl Unlimited podcast. Oh my goodness, Barbara Winter. I have been a fangirl for so long. And this feels so surreal because I can't be more grateful for technology at the moment, because you're all the way in California and I'm here in Hertfordshire, England, and we're able to do this. It's just, it's remarkable. Thank you so much for being on the Girl Unlimited podcast. How are you doing?
I am doing quite fine today. We're having nice weather after weeks of this endless heat wave that I don't do well in heat waves, even with air conditioning. And so I'm, have had a very busy morning. So,
I'm so jealous because it's been, I think today has probably been the coldest we've had in England so far. And obviously it's kind of giving us an idea of what is to come, I'm guessing, because it was really cold. I did go out for a walk today and it was really cold, really cold. Anyway, so, I mean, we've got to meet on Zoom just one time in the, a few months ago. But I first of all came in contact with your work through your book, obviously. I mean, that's probably how a lot of people have gotten to know you. A book that has been in print for, going to 30 years now, hasn't it?
It's quite a long time. It originally came out in 1993. Wow. By the way, it's called Making a Living Without a Job.
Yes.
And then it got updated in 2009 because the first edition did not have any words in it like internet.
Of course.
So, the basic principles in that book are pretty timeless. But absolutely. We just added some of that updated information. So yeah, it just keeps going and going and going.
It's amazing. When I think back at, there are only two books that I can think about. I'm sure there are others, but I mean, there are just a handful of books that I can say have really, really impacted me deeply. The first book, two of them in particular, the first book is a book called No Compromise, which is written by about this Christian inspirational singer-songwriter who died in the 80s. Inspirational story changed me because at the time I was very heavily into music. So that really impacted me. And the second book was yours. In 2011, I discovered your book. Till today, I don't know how I even got the book. To be 100% honest with you, I don't know how that book dropped on my lap. And it's probably why I kind of feel compelled now to pass it on. So every time, I to the best of my knowledge, I have probably bought that book like three times, just gifted it out to people. And it's just because I feel God gifted it to me, because I can't remember how I came across the book, but that book stoked a fire that was obviously somewhere inside. And if I'm honest with you, it ruined me for every 9-to-5 job I took from that point on.
Mission accomplished.
So was there anything in your early years that could have pointed to the fact that you would be inspiring people to go joyfully jobless, and that was going to be the mission, that was going to be your mission in your life?
I don't think early on, but I have a theory that all of us knew what we were going to be when we grew up, and then we got sidetracked by, education and advice and get a job kind of things. But I remember even as a very young person, like if I was at my grandma's house and just kind of amusing myself in my bedroom, I would play school and I would have an invisible class in front of me teaching whatever. And, now if someone said to me, what's your natural habitat? I would say a room full of lifelong learners. And I love that. And I have missed it so much during the last couple of years.
Absolutely. I remember in your book, you did say that you started out your, in terms of job life as a teacher? So you obviously somewhere in the back of your mind knew that is that's a sort of that was a sort of place you would want to be in, isn't it?
Exactly. And yeah, I started out as a high school English teacher. And one of the things about that was that I think in my fourth year of teaching, I had a moment. I can still remember it so vividly. It was like Groundhog Day. And I thought, I can predict with absolute certainty where I'm going to be and what I'm going to be teaching hour by hour, week by week, month by month. If this is March, it'll be Macbeth. And I realized, and I was really young then because I went through college in 3 years. So, you know, I was probably only about 25 years old at the time. I thought, if I keep doing this, I'll have 40 more years of the same year over and over. And it just terrified me.
Yeah.
And I also was surrounded by people who were teaching in the same high school who had been there forever. And I can remember even when I first met most of them, thinking there's no light in their eyes. They're not excited about what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be that person. And so I left at the end of my fifth year of teaching. And this is another astonishment to me. I have never come up to the half hour before I'm doing a Making a Living Without a Job seminar and thought, oh, I don't want to do that again. My thoughts with that always are, somebody's life is going to change tonight.
Wow.
And I just that, you know, and I went into it thinking, if I get to that point where I'm tired of it, I'll stop. But it's never happened. It's amazing. And I think it's a really good clue when we are really practicing our right livelihood, the work gets more, not less interesting the longer we do it.
Wow. Honestly, just what you said about, you know, knowing that someone's life is going to, there's something about purpose, you know, and the especially when it's geared to, and you, when that purpose is a higher calling than yourself. So you're not just looking at yourself and, you know, it's meeting your needs, but the fact that you are impacting other lives, that's incredible. I mean, what else would you want out of life than the fact that, you know, you are able to make a living impacting the lives of other people?
That's right. And, you know, I also had a bit of an epiphany not so long ago where I realized that when you're a writer, it's like you're planting seeds, but you don't really know where they're growing. You just put them out in the world and, you know, I hear from people, of course, but most people who have read my book haven't sent me an email or invited me on their podcast. But, you know, that's really exciting too, to realize those things I care about are out there and the right people are finding it.
Absolutely. That's the beauty of being a writer. And, you know, I am one of those, I'm one of the products, you know, that you've just referred to, because your book, I've read it like at least three times. I read it again this year, and almost every page is underlined, and it's true. Almost every page is underlined, and it still hits as hard. It actually felt like I had never read the book before, which is pretty incredible, I think. And you did say just before we started recording, I just wanted to go back a little bit to your early years. You did mention, you know, that your grandparents who came in from Germany, expats from Germany. Right. And you talked about how they educated the girls. They had this concept of educating the girls and not educating the boys, and how the boys turned out and how the girls turned out. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a mystery in my family, because my aunts and uncles were all born between, I think, 1897 and 1920. So there were six girls and three boys. And for some reason, all six of the girls were encouraged to higher education. And of course, at that time, for a girl, that meant teaching or nursing, which we have some of both. And there was one that didn't go to college and married early, but was really, even though she had jobs, was really a creative, entrepreneurial thinker. And she lived a very long time and kind of became my favorite at the end. She was just, I remember my daughter and I visited her one time, and as we left, my daughter said, I think she might be the wisest one of all.
Wow.
And she was. I mean, she was just really wise and kind and had had so much loss in her life. She was widowed in her 30s and had two daughters. And one of them, who was just about my age and my best friend, was growing up. Karen and I were just inseparable. And her first year teaching elementary school, she was on her way to school one morning and was her car was hit by a train and she was killed. And the other daughter, the elder daughter, also died before my aunt did. So she lost her whole immediate family, but she never lost her faith that life was a wonderful thing. And she still had an obligation to make the best of it. And I remember in her final years, if I would go visit her, she was always busy knitting mittens that she donated to kids that needed mittens in the winter time. And now I do scarves for homeless people. And I think of Marge all the time. It's like, I'm doing the,
I was just about to say that, because I knew that part of your story about your crocheting scarves. And I was like, maybe in some way you know, subconsciously you feel you're projecting her or something. So now that I didn't know about this.
The connection is really very, very similar. And, you know, and that's also, like I mentioned before about writing, when I'm crocheting these scarves, I realize I'm never going to meet the person that gets this.
Yes.
And that's doesn't matter. I'm just about to start number 537.
Wow.
And if anyone had told me at the beginning, I would, and I have never once said, oh, this is so boring. Never. You know, it's just like, this is so exciting. I don't know who's getting them, but somebody's going to be warmer this winter because I did this.
Yes. Yes.
So, and especially during the pandemic, it's been a great stress reliever to have that.
Well, it's interesting to see how we sometimes, sometimes recreate history, sometimes unconsciously. I'm thinking back about the decision that your grandparents made, and you know, they were quite ahead of their time and how they chose to empower females. And then, you know, some years down the line, you're doing the same, just in a different way and a different manner. But you know, I mean, the way you pioneered this whole, you're one of the pioneers of this whole make a living without a job, become self-employed, you know, be independent, be creative, think about, you know, solving problems for other people as opposed to working a job, you know. And you were ahead of your time as well, I would think, and one of the first women I know personally, anyway, in my opinion.
You know, what I think also is so interesting, and I talk about it in my seminars, we often don't know what our best ideas are. And making a living without a job really felt like an accident. I had moved to Minneapolis and I was very busy trying to meet people. So I accepted every invitation, you know, that came along. And when I got to Minneapolis, I was just kind of piecing things together, doing temporary work. I wasn't sure what I was going to do next and that sort of thing. And when I would be talking to someone at a party or dinner, whatever, and they would say, what do you do? And I'd start talking about it. They get this kind of wistful look and they'd say, oh, I wish I could do that. And I'd say, well, you could. And then I would spend the rest of the evening telling them how to make a living without a job, even though there was no title for it at that time. And one day I thought, you know, I would have a better time at parties if I could just get all these people together at the same time and just explain it to everyone. And there was a new adult ed program in Minneapolis, and they were hungry for programs. Mm. And so I sent them an inquiry about doing this class, and they immediately scheduled it. And I still remember a couple days before the class, I got a call from the school saying, "You better know how to make a living without a job, because we've got 70 people that want to take it, but we only have 30 seats."
Oh my goodness.
And so I think we immediately scheduled the second session of it. And I had no idea at that time that that was going to become the foundation of my most successful years in business. And it just felt so right from the beginning. It just felt right.
So were you making a living without a job at the time?
Well, and then the seminars became my living without a job. I stopped doing all these other things I'd been doing. And there I was.
Tell us of some of the things you were doing.
Also, the timing was really exquisite, because right about that time, which was in the early 90s, these independent adult ed programs are popping up all over the country. Mm. And they were mostly, you know, kind of mom and pop businesses. So they were started by people who were self-employed. And, you know, everywhere we went, the class just did really well. So after a couple of years, I was traveling at least 2 weekends out of every month. I amassed 1,000,000 miles on one airline.
Wow.
And went to a lot of places I'd never been before. And then several years later, like in the early 2000s, I started working with Nick Williams in London. And I remember we did a seminar in London, and there were people there from several different countries. Mm. And I thought, this is so, you know, this is evidence. Entrepreneurial spirit is everywhere in the world. And we have always heard here in the US, you know, land of opportunity, which made it sound like if you live somewhere else, you didn't have the same options. Mm. But the kinds of things I talk about could be done anywhere, really, mm. because it's a, you know, very different from a lot of conventional business ideas that it's got to be about, you know, employees and pension plans and big office suites and all that stuff. And it was amazing and felt like a vote of confidence that so many other people really liked that vision, and that's what they wanted to do. And then the internet and all these tools came along that made it even easier to work from home. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I started my first business, which was a different seminar business that I had mentioned to you before we started doing personal development seminars for women. Mm-hmm. I still remember I sent a press release to the newspaper in nearby city. And I got a call immediately from a reporter saying, "Oh, what you're doing sounds so interesting. I really would like to come and interview you. And at that time, in your office, I'd like to come and interview you in your office." And at that time, my office was a card table in my TV room with a typewriter on it. This was even before we had computers. And the moment she said that, I kind of panicked, because working from home was not, it was like my secret. And I said to her, "How about I come to your office?" And she said, "Oh yeah, that would be okay." So
that is incredible. That is incredible. I mean, so working from home was your secret. Now it's like a buzzword, isn't it? Especially with the pandemic.
Yeah. It's like, who would take me seriously? if they knew I was doing this from home. But, you know, because we were going through, I was going through a transition in our thinking of what does business look like. And of course, the time came where telling people I work from home was something I would bring into the conversation early on, but not in those first years of it.
Oh, wow. So how have you managed to successfully, because obviously, like you said, this, I'm guessing, using your words from the book, profit center. So this became your main profit center, if I'm correct. How did you manage to sustain it all through these years? Because you've been through, I mean, you were talking about a typewriter. I don't think a lot of people, I remember, you know, obviously typewriters, but I mean, they phased out really, probably from my teenage years. So you're talking about typewriter, and you've transitioned from that to obviously the new technology and the new tools that we have now. How have you managed to sustain yourself and sustain your business and sustain living without a job all these years?
Well, you know, I think we often think of, and a lot of the advice too sounds like that a business is a creative undertaking, but I think it's also an evolutionary undertaking. And so we start, but it doesn't stay the same. It grows in different ways. So for me, when I discovered writing and putting together my own seminars was really joyful for me. You know, I had a portfolio of those. And during all throughout the 90s, when the independent adult movement was so strong, you know, that kept me busy. I also started publishing a print newsletter, which I still do. And it has gone on hiatus during the pandemic, and I have missed it, and I'm about to hopefully get it up and running again before too long. But, you know, you see opportunities, and sometimes there would be opportunities to do something that would be a short-term project that I would work with. And then I worked, as I mentioned before, with Nick Williams for a while, and we did some programs that, you know, the two of us did together that were new things, but most of the people who came to them had worked with one of us in the past. So we did things both on, you know, in London and some in Las Vegas and different places in the US. And, you know, I still really love that so much. I have not been at all eager to do my seminars online during the pandemic, because that being in a room with other people, I think, is like an extra level of learning.
Yeah.
That is so important. And in fact, in the early days of my seminar in Minneapolis, which I thought was a very kind of conservative place in many ways, I often would start my class by saying, so how many of you came here tonight without telling anyone where you were going? And everyone would raise their hands in the whole room. I'd say, look around. You know, you're in a room full of other crazy people. Who all want to know about this.
Wow.
And so then at the end of the 90s, when the internet came in, the adult ed program started shutting down, which I thought was a real shame. And I still think it's a real shame that so many people don't realize the extra level of learning that comes when you're in person and not just Googling something you're interested about. And so, you know, it's been, but, you know, by the time you have some confidence in your ability to run a business, you also realize that you can create some new things. And I'm huge on talking to people about auditioning their ideas and trying out things to see which ones, you know, are going to grow and should stay in their portfolios. And, you know, that's also been a great exercise for me. And as I mentioned before, the program in Minnesota was new, and you know, anything I would suggest that I wanted to try as a class, they'd put it in the catalog. And sometimes I would be so excited about a subject, but I'd walk out of the class when it was over and think, that wasn't as much fun as I thought it was going to be. And I wouldn't do it again. And then other times, things that I thought, well, this would be okay, turned out to be really fun to teach. So it was, you know, it's that willingness to experiment and realize that some of the experiments are going to be, oh, good, I can cross that off the list.
Absolutely.
Will make room for something that's more appropriate. And so it's a, you know, we're remodeling and renovating our businesses all the time.
Talking about, you know, renovating and remodeling, I know during the pandemic, you started this a new way of serving people, which you called brainstorming sessions with Barbara. And that's how I kind of met you for the first time after, like I said, fangirling out, which is why I said I absolutely love the internet, because obviously I don't think that would have been possible, you know, considering where you're at and where I am. And but I jumped on a brainstorming session with Barbara, and that's how we got to meet for the first time. So how did you come about that idea, and how did you know that was, because I've heard you say this as well, that you know, you should keep asking yourself the question, who has a problem I can solve? So how did you know that was a problem that needed solving and that you put it out there into the world? Was it the same, or did you, was it an idea you auditioned as well?
It was, you know, I don't know. It just came to me. I don't know how that happened. It just came to me. And I mean, I had done a lot of conversations with people I'd had been essentially brainstorming. And I thought, maybe this would work. And it was really funny because when I started talking about it, my friends and family members said, I can't believe you waited so long. It seems so logical. I was like, yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was because I finally had time to fit it in. And it has been such a pleasure. I have enjoyed every single one. And most of the people who I brainstormed with, I don't know beforehand. Some of them are names that are familiar because they're subscribers to my newsletters, and I know they've been in a seminar, but very few people that I actually have known in the past. And it has just, and every, I don't think I've heard two people that had the same idea. And I'm exciting. Well over 100 people I've had brainstorming sessions with.
I had so a marvelous time.
I think, no matter what comes next for me, if I, you know, can start doing seminars again, I think brainstorming is always going to be part of my portfolio because I too have enjoyed it so much.
You were so generous with your time and your ideas and your wealth of wisdom as well. So, I mean, I know it was meant to go for an hour, but you threw in a few more minutes just because I felt anyway that we so vibed. It was an amazing time. And I knew, I mean, obviously before then I had been toying with the idea of, you know, starting a podcast. And I mean, it was a no-brainer when it was time. Yeah. I knew I had to have you on the podcast. And if I'm honest with you, it took me a while to actually ask the question because I was like, oh, is she going to say yes? I mean, is Barbara Winter, for crying out loud? Why would she, you know? So I'm so thrilled that you're here and, you know, sharing all this amazing wisdom with us. So I wanted to find out. So we have this amazing book, Making a Living Without a Job. It's been in print since 1993. And what would you say inspired you to write the book, and why, in your opinion, has it remained relevant after all these years?
Well, it's remained relevant because the principles and the kinds of ideas I suggest are still pertinent. almost from the moment I started doing seminars, people would say, do you have a book? And I would say, oh, not yet, but I'm working on one, which wasn't exactly true. And I was, you know, slightly intimidated by it, but eventually I realized it had to happen. And I started writing it. And I still remember when I got to the point where I had an editor, I had a different subtitle for it. And my subtitle was Winning Ways for Work in the 90s or something like that. And she said, oh no, Barbara, this is going to have a long shelf life. Mm. And I wasn't even quite sure what long shelf life looked like, but we took the 90s out of it.
Well, thank goodness for that.
And, you know, it's so interesting now because one of the big news stories here in the U.S. is about how many people have decided they're not going to go back to their job when the pandemic's over. We're talking like 4.5 million people, you know, that say, no, I'm not going back.
Yeah.
And it's like, why isn't my publisher doing a big promotion on my book right now? I feel like I should be going to bookstores and turning it around on the shelf. So, because a lot of people like you would stumble across it.
Absolutely.
Because it's the moment they need that book. Mm. And so the evolution just keeps going on.
Would you consider writing another book?
I have a couple that are on my computer that are not quite written yet, but I just out of the clear blue sky, I was so surprised. I got an email from a director at Alternatives in London saying, would you be willing to do an online program for us? And I said, sure. I had done some programs with Nick at Alternatives, and I had also done a Monday night talk for Alternatives, which just about did me in because I couldn't believe I was standing there on the altar of Christopher Wren's church, speaking to a church full of people. It was quite a night. But I hadn't had any contact with them for a decade and never with this person. So it felt really kind of magical that she tracked me down. And I wrote this new program, which is called The Joyfully Jobless Path to Prosperity. Mm. And it's really a list of power tools to use when you're building a business. And the thing that I think we don't realize enough when we go from having a job for 20 years to starting our own business is that our mindset really needs to change. Mm-hmm. And I'd say developing an entrepreneur's mindset is a lot like trying to learn a new language, because we really start seeing things and responding very differently than we would have as an employee. And so these are all the things that are in this program aren't things that cost money. It's more about behaviors and thinking, different ways of thinking. Mm. And then almost at the very same moment, I got an email from one of the few independent adult ed programs still in business in Denver saying, do you have a program? So I have done that program now for both of them, and I love it. And I actually had, even before it was a program, I had started working on a book on power tools for building a business that includes a lot of the same information. And then I have been publishing my newsletter for over 30 years. Mm. And that also is mostly about mindset and personal growth kinds of things. And there's some beautiful essays from that. So I've been gathering them and would like to get that published as a book too.
That will be amazing.
So I'm kind of moving in that direction now.
That will be amazing. I mean, talking about mindset, it's honestly, the last 5 years, I did not realize how important a person's mindset. You're talking about the entrepreneurial mindset. If someone had told me, you said it's as different as obviously from someone who has been in a job for 20 years, it's as different. It's as different as learning a new language. If I had to learn that by fire, literally, because me starting a business, a music business, you know, a lot of people obviously see just the performance side of things. People don't realize that there's an actual business behind the scenes, you know, how you organize yourself and what you charge for gigs and everything else. I had to learn the hard way. And another aspect people don't tell you is business really shows you who you are and shows you your weaknesses and your weak points and those areas that, you know, you need a bit of, I don't know, emotional strength and intelligence in. At least that was my experience. What would you say to that?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that I have said this before, I think being self-employed is the best personal growth program ever invented. Because we just keep learning more things about ourselves,
yeah.
Not just learning new things about business and seeing opportunities and getting ideas, but I think it's so interesting how many people often tell me after they start a business that they have so many ideas and they never had ideas before when they were going about their previous life and their 9-to-5 job and all that sort of thing. And I often joke and say, well, you know, ideas, no, they can't get through the wall of a cubicle. So they don't come there. But there is that whole other gift that we get when we take that on. Incidentally, I have just been rereading Carol Dweck's wonderful book, which is titled Mindset. And she talks about the two kinds of mindset. One is the growth mindset and the other is not. And it's fascinating because she did so many experiments with groups from kids to adults, giving them different projects and then monitoring how the growth mindset people dealt with them. And it was so clear. And so I've been just kind of reviewing that whole mindset thing and am very aware of it. I think I've been in isolation for 20 months, pretty much. And so mindset is really important. And I know when I let my guard down and start feeling isolated and cranky and all those things that I don't like being with me. But if I, like, there's nobody else around, what can I do? You know, but when I really take charge of my mindset, I can find all sorts of things to be joyful about. Like crocheting twice as many scarves as I normally would.
Oh, okay. Barbara, let's talk consistency. Okay. You have been publishing this newsletter, Winning Ways, for about 30 years now. And from the research I made, it's the longest running newsletter of its kind. What has kept you consistent all these years? I mean, year in, year out.
Well, I'm one of those people that when I get excited about something, I got to share it. And it's been such a great vehicle for that. I mean, you can't be standing in line at the grocery store and telling them, but I just read the best book. And I also realized that something like a newsletter, which comes out 6 times a year, is really a powerful tool. And that, you know, on the day where you think, oh, I don't know if I'm going to make it, it might show up in your mailbox and exactly what you need is there. At the very least, you might come across Winning Words is on the back page, which is quotes from other people. And, you know, and there might be something there that just like, yes, okay, I'm going to get it back together kind of thing. And I think we, you know, we need to also realize, and people do realize it, but maybe don't realize what that means, is that when we decide to go off on our own, we are volunteering to be in a minority. And many people, especially at the beginning, have a lot of resistance around them with people that they love. And, you know, people who are their family members and their friends who are like, oh, that's really, don't do that. That's not going to work. Don't do that. And so it's really important to realize that we need some people with an entrepreneurial mindset also talking about tools and methods and ways that they sustain themselves. And so this newsletter is a perfect vehicle for that. And it's also perfect because I keep coming across things. You know, I am just an absolute voracious reader. And when I come across a book I love, I am just ranting about it everywhere and that sort of thing. And so it's, you know, I love doing it. And I have a few digital subscribers, but I really intended for it to be a permanent tool. I was just doing a brainstorming session a month or so ago with a woman who probably has been a subscriber for 25 years to the newsletter, somebody I met years ago in Colorado. And all of a sudden she's making this noise. She's like, oh, I've got all your newsletters here. And I can hear her rustling all these papers. Sounds like she has like a file, you know, right next to it. And, you know, it's really intended to be a permanent tool.
Wow. I get your emails. I think it comes once a month. And
it comes whenever I feel like writing it, not on a schedule.
Okay. Every time it comes, though, it's one of the few emails I enjoy reading, because there's just so much in it. There is, you know, a bit of this and a bit of that, and a you know, quotes here and a book recommendation there, and it's just like music to my soul. So, and they're not, I mean, we are living in an age where we're literally bombarded with a lot of material and a lot of content. And I personally think, for those listening, you need to get on her, at least get on her email newsletters, because you would love them. It's refreshing and very different from what we have, what obtains right now.
Thank you. And, you know, and I do try to keep it short, because I do get mailings that just go on and on and on. And if you subscribe to a lot of things, you know, there's just not time to read all of them. And some of them, I just like wish I could edit out a few paragraphs of other people's stuff. So I'm very cautious about that. Mm. And I also, since I, you know, mentioned kind of jokingly at the beginning, I only send them out if I have something to say. I don't do it on a schedule. And if I have something that I'm excited to share, I do a mailing about it. But if I have nothing to say, I don't do one.
I hope you keep doing it, because I love getting them.
I have no plans to stop. I'll tell you that.
Thank God for that. So I was going to say, I mean, you just mentioned that if you decide to go out on your own, you're volunteering to be in the minority. That hit me, because that is so true. And you have to keep yourself going. You have to keep yourself inspired. So for you, Barbara, how do you keep yourself inspired? How have you kept yourself inspired years and years in all your years of doing this?
You know, I think the first thing that really inspired me was a book I read called Supergirls, which was a long, long time ago. I read it before I started my first business. So it was a long time ago when this was not common at all. Hmm. And it was the subtitle was The Autobiography of an Outrageous Business. And it was about two friends in New York who were roommates, I believe. And they started a business. And this was the description of it, doing creative projects, whatever that means. And they got a lot of free publicity. That was kind of their big marketing tool. So when I started my business and contacted the reporter, that's where I got the idea, was from Supergirls. And I memorized the last sentence of the book, and all these years later, I can recite it. We didn't start out being super, we just wanted to be. And I thought, yeah, that's I want to be. And so I think that books certainly are an important part of this. It's also the most powerful thing, I think, is to have another self-employed friend. And we don't need hundreds of them, but we need one. And I can look at the two times in my life when I had a really close entrepreneurial friend, or times where my business grew. And they're the people you call on the day you get a new client and they say, let's go out and have dinner. And they're the people you call on the day when you lose a client and they say you want to talk about it. And you do the same for them. And, you know, you don't need a huge brigade of those people, but you need a few. You need to start seeing where their activities are. You know, there are more and more groups that get together in, you know, all sorts of places for people who are self-employed and women, sometimes very specifically now. A lot of things I'm seeing also on Facebook, and really just exposing yourself to that kind of behavior in sort of a non-judgmental way, more as a curious student. How did they do that? That's really interesting. And, you know, my first really big entrepreneurial friend and I met when we were both living in Colorado, and she ended up moving to Connecticut. And then I moved to Minneapolis. And so our friendship, because this was before we had Zoom and Skype,
of course,
was on the telephone, but we talked very frequently to each other and then visited. And then when I started doing seminars, lo and behold, there were three programs right in her neighborhood, kind of. And so I would go and spend, you know, 10 days staying with her and then teaching classes. And a lot of times she'd come and sit through my seminars and, you know, practically be applauding. Like she'd never heard anything like that before. She was wonderful.
So and your own sharing squad, basically. Having your own sharing squad.
Interest was in herb gardening. So she published a newsletter also. And those years were really, that was really powerful. And then it was very sad because she succumbed to breast cancer. And so she's been gone for a while. And but I realized how, you know, how powerful that was.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's another, I don't know, I'm not sure where it comes from, but something else I remind myself of all the time, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I think, you know, you were ready for my book and I showed up. And I think when we are really listening to our own heart and our intuition, it does help us connect with what we need to make the next step. And so reading to me has just been a really powerful part of my whole journey, as well as hanging out with other entrepreneurs. And, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but once you have that kind of experience, it's really hard to be around people who are 9-to-5ers. I live in this bedroom community of 30 miles north of Los Angeles. And I live in a condominium. And I would guess that the majority of people who live here work in Los Angeles. And which means some of them leave at like 6 in the morning because even though it's not many miles, the traffic is such an issue. And they get back at like 7 o'clock at night. So it's really literally a bedroom community. They sleep here and then they leave. And then they come back here to sleep. And when I first was here, I was like, why do we have such tiny kitchens? I can't bake cookies anymore. It's too tiny. And I realized, well, they thought the people who lived here weren't going to cook anything. They were all going to eat out. But that's that, as I say, that minority that we are in, it really is important to make a connection with them. And I also try to explain to people, I'm not an evangelist. I'm not trying to convert you to this, but if you already know in your heart that this is something you want to explore, I'm a resource.
Wow. You see, that's why we're kindred spirits, because I love books. And I, for a while there, while, having my kids, I did fall by the wayside a little bit, because I obviously at that time I was really busy and I was sleep
Of
deprived
course.
and and stuff. But a few years back, probably about 5 years ago, I did find it again, and then even started a book club, which has been amazing because it's kept me accountable and it's just opened up, the world again to me. It's what got me hungry to start with from when I was a little girl. And like you said, I found your book just at the right time, and there have been many other books I've read since then, but that definitely was the first. That was the window, the first window that opened up to this, this world that's out there. Because prior to reading your book, I don't think I'd read a lot of personal development material or personal growth. I don't think I'd even heard a lot about personal growth, to be honest. I'd actually been try to start a business that didn't do very well and was devastated. And it was at that point I knew, I mean, obviously with hindsight, I knew if I know now that if I'd had the tools that your book presented and subsequent books I read, then it would have been easier for me to deal with, either move on or stick with it, which I actually think I should have. So it's books are amazing. And what you said about just having that community of people, and not so many people, just a handful of you. I remember you telling me this a few months ago as well, and that's how I met Jifu. And I'm actually having Catherine on soon as well, which will be which will be amazing. So what's the best piece of advice you've ever received, Barbara? I mean,
I
you've said
don't
so
know.
many things already, but
I don't know, but there is a little story I want to tell you.
please.
I have a sister. I have more than one, but I have one who was a book rep with a large publishing company for years. So she had a job. And when she left it, she started her own business. Making fascinators. Do you know what a
Yes,
fascinator
I do.
is?
Yeah, the hats, the beautiful
Yes.
hats. Yeah.
I think they're still more popular there than here. And every time I would talk to her in that first probably year where she was on her own, she'd say, "Is it really okay to take money for having so much fun?" And I'd say,
Oh.
"Yeah, it's perfectly okay." And I think, and I realized that I think a lot of us, consciously or not, believe that, well, even if a job was miserable, at least you're getting money for it.
That is a
So
huge
you
money
just keep,
block.
yeah, so
Huge.
you just keep doing it. And the idea that you could be having so much fun and creating something on your own. And then people would give you money for it. We wouldn't even think of that as a reasonable barrier to success, but it can be there. And it's something we also need to be aware of that yes, we're bringing value to the world, and we're again filling a gap that nobody else could do exactly the way we do it. And I love that about it too, that you know, we cannot be reproduced. There are, you know, certainly many, many people writing things about being self-employed today, but my voice is not their voice and vice versa. And that we need to, you know, just keep looking for those connect places where we feel a connection and then see what they bring to our journey.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if you had the opportunity to do it all again, Barbara, would you change anything, if anything? You've had an amazing...
No, I don't think so, because even the things that turned out to be less than satisfying taught me lessons about me. Yeah, that, you know, that's not a good fit for me. And sometimes, you know, I'll see books of advice that make it sound like we all need to do a certain thing. It's like, nah, that doesn't feel right to me. I'm not doing that. And so finding our own way is incredibly powerful. And I think having setbacks and getting back in the game also is powerful. We can remember that. Oh, remember that time when I thought it was all over, and then look what happened. Wow. I have the stamina to keep going and the vision and to keep making things better. I mean, when I get up in the morning, the first thing I think is, how can I make it better today? I don't know what it is. Today it happens to be, the answer to that question was, get all those paper piles sorted, Barbara, and put some of them in the trash and file the others away. That will make your dining room table so much nicer than all these paper piles.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes the answer to that question, how can I make it better, is something very small. But if that is how you spend your day, making things better in whatever way, tell me a better way to live a life.
I hear you. Yeah. How does one develop such resilience, though, to just keep going as you have?
Well, I think part of it is the vision that just keeps pulling and pulling and pulling. And then when you start amassing some memories of wonderful things, like, you know, there was a time before I was self-employed that my desire to travel was so enormous that if I was outside and an airplane flew over, I would start crying because I couldn't figure out how I was ever going to do that. And, you know, I got to the point where I had been to London so many times, I didn't know how many times I'd been there. I lost count. And I remember, in fact, I was coming in. I think this was about the last time I even came through Gatwick. And the customs guy was going through my passport and he kept turning pages and turning pages and they were all stamped. And he said, is the purpose of your trip business or pleasure? I said, pleasure. And he kept turning pages. He said, you mean there's something you haven't seen here yet? And you know, I could have laughed, and he finally found a space to stamp it. And I'm going up the escalator to get my luggage. And I just burst into tears. And I thought, he doesn't know what he said. That 20 years ago, I didn't think I'd even own a passport. And now I have a passport with so many stamps that he can't find a place to have. So, you know, it's moments like that that remind us that we need to keep going in the direction that feels right for us.
Yeah.
And no, it's really powerful. And so even those moments when, you know, when it feels like our things aren't working for us or things aren't working as quickly as we want them to, one of my power tools in my new program is we have to be patiently impatient. And that's not always easy to do.
No, it's not.
And I think one of the things that I often laugh at myself about and other people is like, when I get to the point, it's like, why is this taking so long? And then the answer to that question is, Barbara, you've never done this before. How do you know how long it really is supposed to take? But that's a fine little trick that we often play on ourselves. Well, obviously, there's something wrong with my idea because it's taken too long. It's not happening. That kind of thing. And so I think when we have a long enough track record, most people will look back and say, yeah, there were ups and downs, but I needed the downs so I could see that up was even better than I had been realizing.
So it's just to keep going, basically.
Just keep going. And also realizing that, you know, that your business can evolve and turn into something very, you know, and I tell people the business you start out with is not the business you end up with. As you grow yourself, you see new ideas and new opportunities and that kind of thing. So that, you know, it's nothing like every March, this is Macbeth, that we're doing the same thing at the same time year in and year out. And we learn all sorts of things. Like, for instance, we learn what the best times of the year are for our business and realize that it isn't going to be like this. It's going to be boop, boop, boop.
Yeah. So for those example, who can't see, for the some people might not be able to, not some people, no one is probably going to see this. So Barbara was just, you know, doing the up and down motion with her hand to say that, you know, obviously businesses are not one, they're not in a straight line, but they go up and they go down and go up and down. Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
And there's a seasonal aspect. So for instance, when I lived in Minnesota, where they're very famous for their harsh winters, when I would have classes scheduled in the summertime, we'd have really low enrollments because Minnesotans want to be outside in the summertime. However, if I scheduled classes in July and August in Dallas, where it's 100 degrees, we filled up because everybody's looking for stuff to do indoors. You know, it took me a couple of years to figure out what was going on there, but like, oh yeah, we got a seasonal thing with the weather. And so, you know, then my schedules became more reasonable. So, you know, it's just that sometimes it's just those fun little details that are so delightful. Why would you want to miss them?
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm just going to change gears just quickly because you've talked a lot about it. So it would be, you know, horrible of me not to even bring it up. I'm sure our listeners are probably wanting to hear it. In your book, and obviously in our conversation today, you've talked a lot about, you know, coming to London, and you've talked about, you know, you've just given us the story of this security officer who's just going through your passport and was like, what else do you have to see here? What is your fascination with England?
I fell in love with England when I was about 5 years old. I think what happened, I think it began because my parents got Life magazine, and those were like stories with people. And when Elizabeth was just coming into the spotlight, and I can remember getting up, I had to get up in the middle of the night to watch the coronation. No, I did not, because they couldn't even live broadcast it. They had to record it and then fly it on an airplane to London. And then we saw it, you know, in the afternoon or whenever. But I was in love with it forever. And then when I went to college, I got a degree in English literature. And it was mostly because it was an excuse for me to spend the next couple of years reading a lot of English literature. And so I, from afar, I was just in love with it. and felt some connection. And then I think after my first year of teaching, I went on a tour that began in London. So that was the first time I was actually there. And I was just smitten from the start. I mean, you have water stones, for goodness sake.
We have water stones. Oh, Barbara, honestly, a few months ago, I walked in because we have a water stones in our high street, our local high street here. And I walked into water stones. I was going on my walk, my almost daily walks. And I just stepped into water stones. And oh, the transformation. I just kept taking pictures and I put them online on Instagram. It's honestly a haven for any book nerd. It's beautiful.
I know, it's just so wonderful. And do you still have Wagamama?
Yes. Oh, well, gosh, yes.
I miss Wagamama so much. Kind of the last couple of years that I was coming to London, Wagamama appeared, and I was like, why aren't you in the U.S.? I think I had heard they had opened in Boston, but...
We do have.
Spreading like wildfire here because they had a dish that was like divine.
Interesting. Okay, so one of the reasons I started the Girl Unlimited podcast and what I'm hoping is going to become a community of women who are just breaking barriers and, you know, just stepping into and embracing their unlimited potential. I know the reason that is a vision is because I know personally, and I was one of those women who felt held back by life, by circumstances, by background. What would you advise such women, you know, in terms of how they can break out of those things that are holding them back, the stereotypes, you know, the whatever barriers, mental, you know, barriers? What would you advise them?
I think it's a slow process. Mm. You know, it's kind of a step-by-step process. We don't do it overnight. Mm. And, one of the things that I think is really powerful is just challenging ourselves to do small things we've never done before. And I think that it can be, you know, and not necessarily things that scare us, but just things that, oh, I've never eaten at Wagamama and I have no idea what that kind of food is, but let's go see, you know, and then we come out with a whole new, I want more of that kind of thing. And, you know, and for me, it's like, and I do this to remind myself, is I'm going to make my life a laboratory and I'm going to run experiments.
Oh,
and
gosh.
I'm going to experiment in big ways and little ways. And I'm going to not be judgmental, but I'm going to notice which things we want to keep and which we want to get rid of. And when we outgrow things, and I think, you know, certainly reading can also be powerful. I have discovered, and I, you know, I guess I was just oblivious to it, but this last year I've had time to read more fiction. Mostly I read so much nonfiction, there's no time. And I just realized how many fictional books the main character is an entrepreneur. And I thought, well, that makes so much sense. I mean, yes. If you're going to write an interesting story, how would you do that with a cubicle dweller? How could they be the hero of your story? And in fact, one that I've just been raving about to everybody is called The Last Bookshop in London. And when I got done reading that, I thought, that is like a primer for how to liven up a business. And it's actually written by an American author, I believe.
Wow.
Whose name I remember only, her first name is Madeline, but The Last Bookshop in London, and it's probably out like this year or just last year. Oh. It is wonderful.
I've taken it down. I'm definitely going to get it. I have. You wouldn't, honest. Oh, it's just, I don't know what is going on here, but you know, just this evening, And I was just telling my son earlier today that books and people who talk about books and so booktubers and bookstagrammers are my guilty pleasure. And this evening when I go browsing, you know, so when people browse all sorts of things, the only two things I browse, I browse travel destinations, and you've talked about travel, and books. So people talking about books, people reviewing books. And I was just looking. So today my browsing history was all centered on bookshops. So I'm like, last bookshop in London? Of course I'm going to be interested in that.
I'm waiting for your review. It is just delightful. And I think I was a little reluctant when I started reading it, because I've read several things this last year that took place during the war in London. It's like, I can't take another war story. But this is really so uplifting. And it's actually part of the success of this bookshop came because so many other bookshops had been bombed out of business. Wow. And so there were a lot of bookstores that weren't around anymore, but this one was not in peril, but their troubles came from the inside, not from the outside. And this young woman comes in and has no experience. And that's what I thought too, it'd be so empowering. Here's this person, this young woman, she doesn't really know about running a business, and she transforms this place.
Wow.
And I just thought everything about it is so, it's just like a lesson in how to rescue a business or create a business. I was just, I loved it. Loved it.
I am I've always been a fiction girl. I actually started picking nonfiction, like I said to you. Your book was one of the very first I read cover to cover. Actually, prior to that time, I'd probably done some autobiographies. I'd read a few, but they were usually maybe music history books or stuff like that. So I'd always been a fiction girl. So it's the other way around for her. But I mean, like you said, you get so much from both. And I feel that the wider your range in terms of genres you read, and the more enriching your soul becomes.
And I was going to say that something else that I tell people about being self-employed is we get to design our own curriculum. Yes. And we get to learn from the places we want to learn from, not because we're required to sit through a year of economic classes. So it's, you know, that too can be a power tool for us, is reading fiction and nonfiction that just gives us more ideas.
I absolutely agree. So for a girl right now, or even a boy listening to this, men, women, I like to use girls and boys, I don't know why, stuck in a 9-to-5, let's not say they're stuck, but they are in a 9-to-5 that is, you know, like Barbara Sher puts it, she says a good enough job, you know, at the moment. They're in a good enough job at the moment. But they obviously, like you said, you know, when you were talking to people about, you know, the fact that you are making a living without a job, and they have this wistful look in their eyes, you know, so they desire to have to be joyfully jobless. What would you advise as a sort of transition? Or do they just up and leave immediately, just like, you know, go cold turkey, or do they take it slow?
Depends on who they are. But I also am huge on creating a portfolio of profit centers. And so I tell people, well, if you're not ready to leave your job, think of that as one of the first things in your portfolio. And now you're going to start adding other income sources. And you can decide which ones, you know, evaluate every 6 months or so. Keeping this one, getting rid of this one. And when your other things are starting to generate income, take another look at the job. But it also changes your relationship with the job if you think of it as something in your portfolio. It doesn't own you anymore. It's one of your sources. That's a huge shift. It doesn't sound like it, but it really is.
I hear you. I hear you.
And,
okay.
You know, there was a time in my early days in Minnesota, before I really got my seminars up and running, that I had this opportunity to edit a new personal growth product that a large company was producing. And I did it for a year, and that was all the longer it actually lasted. But it was, you know, and then I started doing some other seminars and things on the side. And by the time I was done being the editor, I had built a strong enough foundation that I could go off and work with some of the infants.
Oh, just two more questions. I know I'm so grateful that you've, you know, gifted me with so much of your time already. I know it's way past. I knew this was not going to be a conversation that would be easy to stop, but I didn't expect it was going to go on this long. So just got two more questions. And it's a question I love to ask my guests, because it's just a way, I guess, of us reflecting back, you know, to, and, you know, obviously using the power of hindsight now. And I usually ask, if you had the opportunity to speak to your 8-year-old self. I don't know why I picked 8, maybe because it's that age where, you know, between 8 and 10, you know, you're still very innocent. It's one of the reasons actually I called it Girl Unlimited and not Woman Unlimited, because I feel like that is an age where you're becoming self-aware and you still remember a lot of stuff, and you're at that stage, your dreams and you still see your dreams from a very innocent, you know, perspective. And then obviously, mm-hmm. as you start growing older and the teenage years hit, and then boys come into the picture, or, you know, it just things begin to change. So if you had the opportunity of speaking to 8-year-old Barbara, what would you say to her?
I would say, spend your life being an explorer. And just keep exploring and look for adventures that feel wonderful to you, even if you don't know anyone else who cares about them.
Oh, that's powerful.
You've got to find your own journey.
Yeah.
And I kind of think 8-year-old Barbara already thought that way. I think she did. Because, you know, with my cousin Karen, who I mentioned before, who was about my age, she lived on a farm. And one of the things that I did on the farm was that I turned it into a town. And we made a map of the farm, and every building, like the house was the hotel.
Right.
And every building had a different, you know, and we had imaginary people who lived in the town. And so, you know, it was always about inventing things. And there were things that, you know, I wasn't good at, like I wasn't a great drawer or artist or those sorts of things. But inventing community, I think, was something I was doing from childhood on. And I just somehow knew there is a much bigger world out there than this little farm town I live in southern Minnesota. And somehow someday I'm gonna go find it.
your superpower was inventing community, and it was already showing that early. That's amazing.
They were imaginary, so they, you know, never gave us any trouble whatsoever.
Of course, it always starts in the mind, doesn't it? It always starts in the mind, and then it has to start from there for it to manifest in the physical, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so you talked about coming to the, you know, I love that story. I mean, it's not the first time I'm hearing it, you know, of you, of the security guard, you know, having your passport and turning the pages and not finding anywhere to stamp. And it is a dream of mine, which is probably why it resonates so well with me. So I'm obviously left with the question, what's next? What's next for Barbara? Because he said, is there anything left for you to see? So my question to you is there anything left for you to see and explore, Barbara?
Oh, absolutely. And ironically, I carry my current passport with me. I've just had its third anniversary, and it's the first time I've ever had a passport with no stamps in it.
Oh.
So I carry it with me in case I just suddenly decide to run off someplace. Just say, that's it, I'm going. I've got my passport, I can go. But I find it kind of sad that I have this passport with no stamps. But at the same time, you know, I recall we are living in a time like no other. Yes. That I've ever been exposed to. And I have to do things in a different way right now. Mm. I have fallen in love, to my amazement, with Mexico. And about 5 years ago, my siblings and I went to the city in Mexico I had never heard of, called San Miguel de Allende. Mm. And it is this incredible creative community, a lot of expats there. Mm. I met this woman, someone had told me to track her down, who is an American woman who started the most wonderful business there. And she loves textiles, and she started this business and wanted to involve the community. And they make clothing. She has 17 local seamstresses. So wow. She has given them all. And I mean, her things, like she'll do Frida Kahlo fabrics. Her things are being sold in museum gift shops all over the US and other places in the world. Just wonderful. And I have never been anywhere that has had the same kind of impact on me as San Miguel. I have thought of it every single day since we came back. And I realized it would, you know, it's at a high altitude, and with my breathing problems, that living there permanently is not an option for me, but going back, certainly. But I never expected that. I have totally changed my mind about what Mexico is like. I had only seen little bits of it before, and always just heard about, you know, it's full of drugs and crime, and it's absolutely exquisite. The artisans that do all sorts of things there it's just mind-boggling. I just saw, in fact, the other day, somebody posted on Facebook some of the street art from San Miguel. You know, her whole side of the buildings are muraled and just lovely. Another trip that I took with my siblings that I figured out we really didn't get everything in, I named Stalking Van Gogh. And we started in Amsterdam and went to the Van Gogh Museum. And then the rest of it was in the south of France. And we stayed, we had rented a farmhouse sort of out in the country. Near Arles, where of course one of his most famous paintings is,
yes.
And San Remy, where he was in the mental hospital. In fact, I have a t-shirt, I wore it yesterday, that came from the hospital gift room with some of his paintings on. But that's not the best part of the story, T. And then after that, we went and spent our last weekend on that trip was in Paris, and we had no real plans for that. And so we came in on like maybe on a Saturday, and we're staying two nights. And on Sunday we got up and like, oh, well, maybe we could go to a museum. And so we decided to go to Musée d'Orsay. Unbeknownst to us, they were having the largest Van Gogh exhibit ever, with paintings from private collections and museums all over the world, including a painting of his that my sister and I had gone to LA to see in a museum down there. Not a real well-known one. And when we got in front of it, Margaret and I were together. I was like, that's our painting. Again, tears. So we've had some wonderful trips to Italy. There aren't a lot of places I haven't been that I want to go, but places I would love to go back to.
Wow.
So
Honestly,
I'm hoping not.
I've had this smile on my face all through this interview. And listening to you talk about travel as well, and it's literally making my mouth water. I mean, what an amazing experience. Just seeing Van Gogh's paintings going on. Oh, that's just amazing.
Oh,
That's
that was the most amazing trip. And it was just wonderful. And that's another thing I'm big on with travel and also with projects, is to give our projects a theme. And I like to do that also with trips. And when I started coming to London regularly, every trip I had a different theme for. So like one time it would be museums, another time it would be gardens. That kind of thing, because other it just is more focused. And I also just had the assumption I would be coming back. I didn't have to see everything this time around, and I wanted to,
I think I'm going to do the same. You've really inspired me
and
now.
I
I think
even
I'm going
made
to do
it
the
to the
same.
Chelsea Garden Show one year. That was
Is
fine. Yeah, that was kind of cool.
Oh my
So.
goodness. How do you want to be remembered? I just can't end the interview without asking that question, because you've had such a rich life so far, and I mean, just listening to you has been, I'm inspired, and I know that our listeners will be inspired as well. So how do you want to be remembered?
I think I would like to be remembered as somebody who made a difference. My granddaughter is getting ready to apply for college, and she had to write essays, an essay. And she wrote this essay about how her grandmother had really inspired her to stick with her art.
Wow.
And of course, it brought me to
Of
tears.
course.
And it was like, wow. And she has started, like, it was just my birthday a week ago, and she now makes birthday cards for me. And last year was the first time she had done it, and it had books on the cover and a bookworm. And then wrote about all these memories from what she remembered us doing together, like having tea parties and things that we did to reading together. And yeah, I would like to be remembered as someone who is remembered for adding to the joy on the planet and helping people find themselves and find their own contribution and realizing that the contribution they're going to make is, if they don't do it, it ain't gonna be there. The planet will be missing something because nobody else will do it exactly the same way as you. And I think that's a huge revelation for us because I think our culture has worked very hard to kind of compartmentalize us. And that moment we realized, no, nobody else had, and that was an early revelation for me, where I realized nobody else has had the life I've had. And I have resources that I know people haven't discovered themselves. I would need to share them.
Of
So
course.
it's about as simple as that and as complicated and as powerful.
It is powerful. And that is just,
Yeah.
that's the perfect place to end the interview. I am so thrilled. Honestly, I can't wait to release this episode, because I know it's going to impact lives the way it's impacted me, just being the one listening. I feel so privileged being the first person to listen to it. So even though I was the one asking the questions, but I honestly don't have the words to thank you for just taking out time, for gifting, being so generous with your time. And I don't know, I think you're phenomenal. I love you so much. I love what you stand for, everything that you do, and how you show up in the world as this badass rock chick. Somehow you just keep reinventing yourself, and I think it's amazing. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I just posted last week on Facebook, My new hobby is being a podcast guest. And although I don't have a podcast myself or have a plan to have one, I love being on podcasts. And this, you made this really fun.
Oh.
So I liked your questions and I liked where you took me on this journey. So thank you. And, you know, if you have, you know, a guest that disappears on you or something, you need somebody in an emergency, I'm always here.
Yay! I'm going to hold you to that.
Well, until the pandemic's over, then you might have a hard time finding me.
But yeah, no, that's amazing. I probably will hold you to that because I'm sure we will want you back after this one goes live. So yeah, thank you.
Okay. I would love to.
Thank you.
And I of course would love to have a link to it and I'll tell people about it. But if you wanted to add it, maybe as you post it and send out, and tell people about my website is joyfullyjobless.com so they can find out more about what goes on with me.
I actually almost forgot that. I'm so sorry. Where can they find you? So jobless, it's a joyfullyjobless.com.
That's right. And they can sign up for my emailing there and they can also order my newsletter there, Winning Ways, and just find out what's going on. So Right now, of course, there aren't many events printed on there, but there's articles and that kind of thing. So
that's amazing. I already said to you guys that it, honestly, her email newsletters, if you've seen emails that come into your box, ignore them because Barbara's emails are phenomenal. They're light, they're interesting, they're funny. Sometimes you throw in a joke or two there and it's just, it's lovely. It just puts a smile on your face. And like I said, I don't know. And I subscribe to a lot of newsletters because, you know, because I'm a copywriter and I do email marketing for people from time to time. So it helps me and my work. So I get a lot of emails and honestly, not a lot are like yours. So congratulations on that. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You can probably cut this into two programs.
Right. Honestly, I didn't realize it was going to be this long. You, my friend, are a total rock legend for listening to this episode to the end. I hope you found value in it. And if you did, would you do me a quick favor? Would you rate and review this podcast on the platform you're listening? And if the platform you're listening doesn't have the facility to rate and review, then please share the episode with your friends and your loved ones. It will go such a long way in helping spread the word of this podcast. And until next time, remember you're a unique, remarkably created person with a God-given purpose and unlimited potential. The question is, what are you going to do about it?
You thought that nothing will become of me, that I'll never come to anything, but I rise. Yes, you might have given up on me, 'cause you couldn't see what I see when I